Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. More than a year has passed since South Sudan voted to secede from Sudan and become an independent country. But after months of escalating tension, the two Sudans are once again on the brink of an all-out war. And once again, the Sudanese government is facing international condemnation for its brutal crackdown on its own rebellious people. The Sudanese government has been bombing the Nuba Mountains in the Blue Nile state just north of its border with South Sudan for months now. The Sudanese government has also closed the area to humanitarian relief workers and to journalists. However, our guest on Global Journalist today was able to visit Blue Nile recently after a period of heavy bombing. The authors of the New York Times multimedia project that used Pete Muller's photos said he provided a rare glimpse of the rebels who are now fighting to overthrow the government in Khartoum. Pete Muller also reported recently from a South Sudan region that produces oil, the product that seems to be the underlying cause of the warmongering. Pete, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thanks very much for having me, David. I appreciate it.
So you just had a break with your wife in Kuwait, and now you're back in Juba. Just to give us some background for our listeners, since 2009, Pete has worked to document the South's social and political fabric during its historic transition to independence. His photographs and multimedia projects have won numerous awards. And the Open Society Foundation in New York City exhibited his documentary photography. In 2011, he was named Wire Photographer of the Year by Time magazine. Here in the U.S., last month, movie star George Clooney was led away in handcuffs after trespassing at the Sudanese embassy. He was protesting the actions of the country's president, Omar al-Bashir, an alleged war criminal. He also testified before a Senate committee and met with President Obama to discuss the dire humanitarian crisis in Sudan. What did people in South Sudan say about Clooney's actions, if they even heard about it?
I think the government of South Sudan was certainly very appreciative for George Clooney's efforts here. Not just Clooney, the efforts of John Prendergast from the Enough Project, who facilitates a lot of Clooney's visits here. Certainly when you bring in somebody like Clooney, you know, you're able to capture the attention of a lot of people who might not otherwise have any level of awareness about what's happening in South Sudan. So there's certainly an appreciation for what Clooney's done here.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof helped bring the Western world's attention to what he describes as a humanitarian catastrophe on the Sudan side of the Nuba Mountains. He wrote in February that Sudan's strategy there, he called it a scorched earth counterinsurgency, feels like an echo of what Sudan did in Darfur. Do you agree with that comparison?
I mean, I have not worked personally in Darfur, although I'm familiar with the dynamics of counterinsurgency that happened there. And certainly the government in Khartoum is very heavy-handed when they're dealing with insurgencies within their borders. And I think definitely there's an interest in Khartoum in using very severe tactics to try to suppress this rebellion, particularly after Omar al-Bashir was willing to concede half of his country after the Southerners voted for independence last January. So he's, I think, certainly interested in placating some of the hardliners up in the north and dealing with this rebellion that's broken out since July of last year in a very heavy-handed way.
And let's talk about Blue Nile. Why did you want to go there, and how did you manage to get into that rebellious region?
Well, we wanted to go to Blue Nile largely because the insurgency that broke out in June of last year in the Nuba Mountains had certainly eclipsed what was ultimately a second theater of the rebellion that's happening across southern North Sudan. There was not much news at all coming out of Blue Nile, so we wanted to get up there and see what the situation was so that there could be some kind of representation of the fact that there was, in fact, two theaters of rebellions and two theaters of counterinsurgency. So we were invited by the rebel commander of the SPLM North, a man named Malik Agar, who is ultimately the field commander and large political representation of the SPLMN. And he arranged for us to come to what was at his at that point, his stronghold in a city called Kurmuk, which was right on the border of the Republic of Sudan, South Sudan, and Ethiopia. So his troops invited us up, and we spent about 5 days observing the situation in and around Kurmuk.
Tell us about what you saw there and what you photographed.
We found a city that the inhabitant count prior to the outbreak of war in September was significant. I mean, I think it's around tens of thousands of people, I believe, lived in Kurmuk. And when we found it in October, it was utterly deserted. We flew into an airstrip, and the airstrip is maybe 10 or 15 minute drive from the center of town. And the civilian population of Kurmuk at that time had completely fled. You saw, you know, the occasional civilian, but by and large, it was a garrison town held by the SPLMN rebels.
Right.
We, you know, all of the shops were closed. Many of the inhabitants had fled across the border into both the northern parts of South Sudan and across the border into Ethiopia. And the SPLMN rebels at that time were sort of holed up there and waiting to see what the Sudan Armed Forces would, what kind of track they would take in terms of trying to rout them out. We moved around outside of the town up towards sort of the front line areas, and there was fairly consistent bombing by Antonov fighter jets that hover around the area and you know drop bombs sort of throughout the day periodically. We were forced to pull off the road at one point when we were en route to meet Malik Adar and wait for a sortie to pass over us. You know, all of the remote villages were emptied. What people were there were living very, very deep in the bush. They really had very little to live on. There was little access to clean drinking water. There was virtually no food to be had, and certainly the civilian population was quite terrified.
How close did the bombing come to where you were?
We sort of took shelter in a creek bed, and I if I had to estimate, I'd say that the explosions were maybe a mile away. I mean, they were loud enough that we could really hear them, but I didn't feel we weren't in the way of any fragmentation or anything.
I know that a lot of the turmoil here is about oil, and one of your other assignments recently was in the oil-producing region. Sudan has the oil production and transportation infrastructure, and South Sudan has the crude oil, but they can't seem to agree on the oil pipeline fees that the South should pay. And in January, the South shut off oil production, so both countries are now facing an economic crisis. Tell us about your trip to the oil fields and what people are saying about this brinkmanship.
Well, I mean, certainly brinkmanship is a real characteristic of the interaction between the government of South Sudan and the government of the Republic of Sudan, and it's been that way for quite a long time. We often have these kinds of situations here where, you know, an outbreak of conflict will happen. There'll be accusations of various sides supporting rebel groups. And this has been ongoing for a number of years. And oftentimes it feels that you're headed right to the precipice of a renewed armed conflict. And they do have quite, in a way, sort of a commendable ability to go right to the brink and come back from that. Although we are seeing now, as a result of this oil shutoff, which is, as you mentioned, really, creating an atmosphere of real economic catastrophe. We're seeing violence along the border in these areas that are oil rich, particularly the southern South Sudan's Unity State. We're seeing violence there and actual army on army confrontations that haven't happened for really quite some time. So this is really a new level of tension between these two countries.
How is it affecting South Sudan economically already?
Well, the South is dependent. 98% of its annual budget and revenue comes from the sale of its crude oil reserves. So when that was shut off very abruptly, the government of South Sudan announced in the weeks or about a month after the shutdown that there would be austerity measures in South Sudan. There would be some of the additional spending in terms of allowances for parliament members and other things were said to be trimmed. And one thing that we could see, I noticed visibly on the street, was that, you know, any basic services that were starting to become in place around the time of the referendum and independence, particularly that of, like, trash collection and sanitation, it seems that those sectors were certainly some of the first to go in the austerity measures. Over the past several weeks, we've seen large mountains of trash and just a real deterioration of the sanitation in Juba, which was something that was quite visually noticeable.
Now, the presidential summit in Juba was scheduled to take place this month, but it was canceled. Were you planning to cover that event? And is that cancellation, was that a disappointment to people?
Well, certainly people were looking forward to, you know, that step forward in terms of Salva Kiir and Omar al-Bashir having an opportunity to sit down and see if they couldn't resolve this this major oil issue. And certainly people were disappointed about the fact that the summit wasn't able to happen, but I think people are at this stage much more concerned about the severe violence and escalation that's happening along the border. I think that's eclipsing the disappointment of the meeting of the two presidents.
I want to talk a little bit about what happened to two of your colleagues who were killed last April in the fighting in Libya. War correspondent and documentary filmmaker Tim Hetherington and award-winning photojournalist Chris Hondros. Tell us about where you were when you heard this news and what impact their deaths had on you personally.
Well, I was out on an assignment. It wasn't really an assignment. It was sort of a larger project that I've been working on with an NGO that was looking at the issue of violence among pastoral communities in South Sudan. So I was in a very, very remote area tracking cattle camps where there'd been a lot of violence. And I was just waking up in the morning. I was sleeping outside, and the guard at the compound where I was sleeping had a radio. And I just vaguely, quickly, as I was sort of waking up, overheard that Tim Hetherington and Chris Hondros were killed in Misrata. And I was in sort of a state of disbelief. And because I was so far away, it wasn't possible for me to immediately verify what I'd heard. And I thought maybe I'd misheard something. And, you know, those guys were very seasoned in terms of combat photography. And it was quite a surprise to hear that something like that had happened to them. I had never had the good fortune to meet either of them. I'd always certainly admired both of their work, particularly Tim Hetherington's most recent work, not just Restrepo, but the photographic book that he put out as a compliment to Restrepo called Infidel. I mean, I think Tim Hetherington's work was absolutely among the highest echelon of in-depth photographic documentation that's been happening in the last few decades. He was really right. It was an extraordinary loss for the photographic community.
I know that they were an inspiration to you. Who else? You mentioned in one of your blogs that when you were in college, you read a book about humanitarian aid worker who traveled to conflicted countries. Tell us about how you got started in this line of work.
Well, when I was in university, I went to American University in Washington, D.C., and I studied history and international peace and conflict resolution. And by and large, my interest in the field that I'm now pursuing as a photographer is really more of a kind of academic intellectual interest that was really fostered during my years in college, studying the histories of conflicts that by and large were the products of clashes of national identity. So I was really inspired by and large by journalists that wrote sort of retrospective narratives of their experiences in places like former Yugoslavia, parts of Central Africa, Philip Gorovitch in Rwanda, people that were really exploring both, you know, in the written word, these conflicts of national identity, and certainly people who were making pictures. I was very influenced by a well-known photographer named Ron Haviv, who he's done tremendous work in a number of places, but I was particularly influenced by his book about the dissolution of Yugoslavia, which is a book called Blood and Honey, where he really documented all of these communities in Croatia and Bosnia that were really, you know, hit hard by the interfactional fighting that was ultimately about national identity and that collision.
What are you hoping to accomplish with your photography and multimedia reporting in Sudan and South Sudan?
I hope that the work that I'm doing can sort of add to the discourse of national identity issues and state power. That's ultimately what motivates a lot of the work that I do. I'm very interested in post-colonial environments where state boundaries were drawn, in many cases arbitrarily, around many nations of people, which were ultimately lumped into modern states. So what's guided the work that I've done here in particular is that interest of there are fundamentally many nations within the state of South Sudan, and there were many nations within the broader unified state of unified Sudan. And I'm very curious about how these conflicts play out. How can groups that identify themselves as respective nations, is it possible to build new national identities that surpass these tribal and ethnic identities? And I hope that the framework that I've taken and the work that I've done is able to add something to that discourse.
Now, well, your photos certainly humanize the terrible conditions and the impact of what this fighting is happening having on these people. And I wanted to talk about a few of your maybe some of your favorite photographs from the where these conflicts are taking place in Sudan and South Sudan. One photo that was particularly moving to me at the edge of a temporary tent settlement, it looks like in the shade of banyan trees, an elderly man is being led by a younger woman holding the end of his walking stick. Do you remember that photo? And can you tell us about that and some of the other?
I do, yeah. That photo was taken. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. What was happening with there? Where that photo was taken?
Well, that photo was taken in a very small town called Turele, which is about 2 hours from a very highly contested, highly politicized border community called Abyei, which is claimed both by the North and by the South. And in May of last year, a few months before the South was set to declare independence, the government in Khartoum launched a massive offensive against Abyei. And a lot of people suggested that the offensive was really aimed at driving out the Nokdinka, which are the southern sort of African residents, ethnically African residents of Abyei. And it was very successful. There had been an offensive in 2008 against Abyei where the town was essentially burned to the ground. And by all accounts, this attack on Abyei last year surpassed that significantly in terms of its intensity. So thousands, tens of thousands of people had fled Abyei however they could, on foot, on motorcycle. They were hiding in the bush. And this area of Turele had accepted a lot of the people in the days and weeks that followed the Abyei offensive. And that young girl was providing some basic assistance mm-hmm. to an older man who was blind. And they were sleeping outside of a small community center along with thousands of other people. And I thought it was a really sort of touching moment to see that cross-generational support between a young girl that I presume she actually didn't know him. I would wager that she's not a relative of his, but that she was just providing assistance of guiding him around in a new environment that he wasn't familiar with, because his old environment was no longer, he no longer had access to it.
Another one was particularly powerful was a woman on an operating table after having bullets removed from her torso. Tell me why you selected that photograph.
Well, that photograph was also, it was part of, actually, I think I took that photograph either the same day or the day after Tim Hetherington and Chris Andros were killed. That woman, the area where that photograph was taken is sort of a nexus point of three heavily pastoral communities in South Sudan, and the amount of violence that pertains to cattle rustling, these kinds of things, creates an awful lot of armed violence there. And that woman had been shot in an altercation, and she was at the one sort of semblance of a medical facility that exists in that part of the South. And she had just had, I think, two bullets removed from her. And I thought it was, I don't like photographing in hospitals. I find it a very difficult experience, and I try to avoid it when I can, but sometimes I feel it's necessary to show, you know, to try to illustrate how severe some of these situations can be. And I find that picture to be, you know, I find it affects me personally quite a bit. Yeah. In terms of being a singular individual representation of an experience that a lot of people are having across this country,
right,
where people are living in communities that are heavily armed. The amount of small arms and light weapons in this country is astounding. And the violence as a result is so much more deadly by virtue of the fact that these weapons are so prominent.
Now, I want to also talk to you about your photography while you covered the long-awaited independence referendum. But before we continue, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. We'll also have a slideshow of the work that Pete's done in Sudan and South Sudan. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. And you can also follow us on Twitter at GJJournalist. And Pete, you were in South Sudan before and after the vote last, I guess about 14 months ago, and you wrote in your blog that you were a bit surprised by the calmness of the referendum. Tell us about what surprised you, and also whether independence has made the situation any better.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we were all bracing for a very jubilant kind of atmosphere when independence was declared and when the referendum happened. You know, certainly there was a very unified voice across all the states of the South for independence. It was a very, very coveted, very long-awaited development that people have been fighting in the South for, you know, since 1955 there's been civil war here. And, you know, as that civil war progressed, the desire for independence grew. That said, I felt that the reactions to independence were tempered by the fact that there are a tremendous amount of internal political grievances among the Southerners themselves that I think cast a fair degree of concern and doubt into the minds and hearts of the people here. While everybody was certainly excited to be through with the dynamic of being governed by an unrepresentative and fairly hostile government in the North, I think people are concerned about how the Southerners will begin to reconcile and move forward among themselves. So I think that as independence was happening, that was on some people's minds, and certainly the president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir, is not one for enthusiastic gestures or statements that suggest that you know, everything is going to go swimmingly. He's a very cautious and very pragmatic leader. And I think that his position on things, which was quite tempered, I think that trickled down to most of the population as well.
And one of your photographs shows the president wiping sweat from his brow at a pre-independence press conference. Why did you select that photo? Did that sort of indicate the pressure that was going on? Tell us about that, why you chose that photo as one of the main ones for the coverage of the independence vote.
Yeah, I mean, I think that particular frame as he's wiping sweat from his brow, to me, as sort of as an interpretation, you know, the vast majority of the leadership in South Sudan that sits in government now were members of the rebel forces, of the SPLA forces under John Garang. The leadership that exists now politically was by and large a military rebel-based leadership during the days of the Civil War. And it's been one thing that I've found to be profoundly interesting here is the transition of a rebel movement, an insurgency movement that, unlike so many others, was able to actually achieve the goal of capturing the state apparatus. And while that certainly empowered them to a great degree and attained a number of their goals that related to it, it comes with a lot of pressure, and a lot of adjustments have been necessary and are still necessary for this rebel leadership, one-time rebel leadership, to successfully govern a state and all of the challenges that come along with that, particularly in a place like South Sudan that is so underdeveloped with such low development indicators, with so many developmental challenges. I think the pressure that these guys are under to make this project work is really profound, and I thought that that picture sort of got at some of that pressure.
Right. I've got one last question. We've got about a minute and a half left. The conflict is escalating, and I presume that that you're going to, just covering this, what's happening, you're going to go to some of the worst areas in those two countries. What do you predict is going to happen in the next few months?
Well, you know, it's really difficult to say, and I wouldn't really want to speculate too much. I mean, at the moment, as I said before, the violence that's happening along the border right now is very, very concerning. I think people across the board, the southern Sudanese, the northern Sudanese, the international community, I think is very concerned about this escalation. And, you know, the fact that, as reports are coming in, that southern forces have in fact crossed the border into North Sudan and are now occupying areas around one of the large oil fields north of the border, the Heglig oil field.
Right. This is
very severe escalation, and as bombing continues in the south, in the areas in Unity State, certainly it seems there's room for additional escalation. I trust that there's an awful lot of back channel negotiation that's going on to try to stave off a full return to conflict.
Now, I have to cut you off there. Sorry, Pete. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today from South Sudan was photographer and multimedia reporter Pete Muller. Pete, good luck in the coming months covering that conflict, and I wish you safe travels. Now, Global
Journalist, thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Sravani Pair was our lead producer, assisted by Allison Pasek and John McClure. Now, stay with us for Free Press Watch, and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist, where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Lainey Mullen. Today's news comes from the AP, The Atlantic, The Huffington Post, Lebanon's Daily Star, The New York Times, and Reporters Without Borders. The Israeli government declared a German Nobel laureate poet unwelcome in the country because of a poem. Gunter Grass wrote, "Why do I say only now, aged and with my last ink, that the nuclear power of Israel endangers the already fragile world peace? Because it must be said." The poem has sparked international controversy and resurrected a debate over Germany's burden of history to the Jewish nation. Protests have become common in Greece in these tough economic times, and both demonstrators and riot police have committed violence against journalists. Last week, Marios Lolos, a prominent photographer, was beaten over the head by police and suffered a fractured skull. In Lebanon, public and internet outcry led to the effective withdrawal of a bill proposed to regulate internet activity. Meanwhile, in the United States, the House is contemplating its own Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, which was written to deter cybercrime, and which would allow the government and private companies to monitor and censor the internet. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Lainey Mullen. See you next week.